At the same moment, I opened the door to the Starhenge. Daylight flooded through. I cringed. How could this possibly go unnoticed? Calm down, I told myself. Only 4 people are in the well where they can see this, and all eyes are on Fra Paflagon. Looking down one more time, I discovered a flaw in that logic. All eyes were on Fra Paflagon, except for Fra Paflagon's. He had chosen this moment to tilt his head back and gaze straight up. And why not? It was the last time he would ever look on this place. If I'd been in his situation, I'd have done the same. I could not read his facial expression at this distance, but he must have seen the light flooding through the open door. He stood frozen for a moment, thinking, then slowly lowered his gaze to face Statho.
"I, Fra Paflagon, answer your call," he said.
The first line in a litany that would go on for another minute or two. I passed onto the Starhenge and closed the door softly behind me. I'd been expecting that everything would be filmed with dust and speckled with bird droppings. Orlo's Fids spent an inordinate amount of time up here keeping things clean. But it wasn't too bad. Someone must have been coming up here to look after it. I came to the windowless blockhouse that served as laboratory, passed through its light-blocking triple doors, and fetched a photomnemonic tablet, blanked and wrapped in a dust jacket. What image should I record on it? I had no clue what it was that the hierarchs didn't want us to see, so I had no way of knowing where I should aim a telescope. Actually, I had a pretty good idea what it must be. A large asteroid headed in our direction. That was the only thing I could imagine that would account for the closure of the Starhenge. But this didn't help me. I couldn't take a picture of such a rock unless I aimed Mithra and Mylax directly at it, which was impossible unless I knew its orbital elements to a high degree of precision, to say nothing of the fact that aiming the big telescope in these circumstances would draw everyone's attention. But there was another instrument that didn't need to be aimed, because it couldn't move, Clesthera's eye. I started jogging toward the pinnacle as soon as this idea entered my head. As I climbed the spiral stair, I had plenty of time to review all of the reasons that this was unlikely to work. Clesthera's eye could see half of the universe, from horizon to horizon, it was true. The fixed stars showed up as circular streaks, owing to the rotation of armor on its axis. Fast-moving objects showed up as straight paths of light. But the track made by even a large asteroid would be vanishingly faint, and not very long. By the time I had reached the top of the pinnacle, I'd put these quibbles out of my mind. This was the only tool I had. I had to give it a try. Later, I'd sort through the results and see what I could see. Beneath the fisheye lens was a slot carved to the exact dimensions of the tablet in my hand. I broke the seal on the dust jacket, reached in, and got my palm under the opaque base of the tablet. I drew off the dust jacket. The wind tore it out of my grip and slapped it against the wall just out of reach. The tablet was a featureless disc, like the blank used for grinding a telescope mirror, but darker, as if cast in obsidian. When I activated its remembrance function, its bottommost layer turned the same color as the sun, for that was the origin of all the light now striking the tablet's surface. Because the tablet was out in the open with no lenses or mirrors to organize the light coming into it, it could not form an image of anything it saw. Not of the bleak winter sun lobbing across the southern sky, not of the icy clouds high in the north, and not of my face. But that was about to change. And so before doing anything else, I drew my bolt over my head and shaped it into a long, dark tunnel. If this precaution actually turned out to be necessary, that is, if this tablet ever found its way to the Warden Regulant, I'd probably be found out anyway. But as long as I was up to something sneaky, I felt an obligation to do a proper job of it. I introduced the tablet into the slot below the eye and slid it home, then closed the dust cover behind it. It would now record everything the eye saw, beginning with a distorted image of my bolt-covered backside scurrying out of view, until it filled up which at its current settings would take a couple of months. Then I'd have to come back up here and retrieve it, a small problem I had not even begun to think about. As I was descending the pinnacle, thinking about this, something big and loud and fast clattered across the empty space between me and the millenarian's crag. It scared the life out of me. It was 1,000 feet away, but it felt as immediate as a slap in the face. In tracking its progress, I sacrificed my balance and had to collapse my legs to avoid toppling from the railless stair. It was a type of aircraft that could rotate its stubby wings and turn into a two-bladed helicopter. It made a slicing downward arc, as if using the Minster as a pylon, and settled into a steep glide path aimed at the plaza before the day gate. My view of this was blocked from here, so I rose carefully to my feet, ran down to the base of the pinnacle, then sprinted across the lid of the Starhenge. Realizing that I was about to hurl myself from the Presidium, something I no longer cared to do, I aimed myself at one of the megaliths, put on the brakes, and stopped myself by slamming into it with my hands. Then I peered around its corner just in time to see the aircraft, rotors now pointed up, settling in for a landing on the plaza. The rotor wash made visible patterns in the surface of the pond and splayed the twin fountains.